Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to invite you into my home. Thank you for coming. Come on in. Take a seat. Today, we're going to be talking about a lot of stuff. But I'd like to start by saying that recently I started focusing on my mental health, and I started seeing a therapist, which is something I advocate for anyone out there to do if you have any interest, even if it's a small interest, to go talk to somebody. I encourage you to go try. The thing about therapy is that it's definitely bound within the concept of a human relationship. So you have to find somebody that you like, and you have to find somebody that is pushing you or helping you in the direction that you need. I've had a lot of therapists in the past that would allow me to just talk at them, which never was the most beneficial or helpful thing for myself. I can talk at a wall. It's a big reason why I started the show, is because I desperately needed an outlet, and a lot of people in my personal life didn't have the time to listen, so I decided to talk to a microphone. And now that desire has grown. But the thing about a good therapist is that they have to bring something to the table. They have to have some bit of knowledge or some bit of idea to push you, you know. I needed to find somebody who could challenge me in a way. And so my therapist, Jen, has been challenging me. And she doesn't let me just talk. And so we've been reading a book together called No Bad Parts by a guy named Richard Schwartz. He is a practitioner of this therapeutic model, which a therapeutic model is any strategy when approaching therapy. And there's a bajillion of them. There's a lot of different models for even community service or even social work. So that's what I'm trying to say, is that like a therapeutic model is a small niche, and it's kind of where like cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, that's another one that a lot of people would know of. And the one that is the inverse of what the one I'm talking about today is family therapy, which is something that I have been involved with my son for a long time. I wish I'd been seeing family therapists when I was younger. I think me and my dad would have benefited from that, to have some sort of mediator between me and him to help us be better together. So family therapy is another model. And the idea of family therapy is that you take the human relationships between people in a family, and if you can help them work better together, then the internal behaviors and feelings and emotions will come with that. So it's like if you have a very stressful family life, of course you're going to be depressed and anxious and afraid to come home, you know? But if you can start to make that family life a healthy, wholesome place to be, then you're no longer afraid to be home. So the therapeutic model of Dr. Schwartz is called IFS, or Internal Family Systems Therapy. So it's the same idea as external family systems, but it's on the inside, which I found quite endearing. So in the very beginning of Mr. Schwartz's book, he basically says that we all are under this illusion that we are one composite being. I, me, this thing, my personality. But he says that when we approach many different situations, we have a lot of different ways that we can approach them. We have different selves for different times and places. Your self when you're being a lover is different than when you're being a worker. Your self when you're happy is different than when you're being sad. So it's looking at all these parts of our being. We have a multifaceted self on the inside, which I really liked. It soothed and fit into the philosophy that I'm building for myself, and I'll get into that later. So there's three different types of parts, but they're like group names for parts. So like within this group, there could be many different types of that type, you know. And then he also even says this really murky thing about how parts can have parts, and that the reason that a part is so conflicting and confusing is because it's actually multiple things going on at the same time. So it's a very scientific way to look and examine our insides of our mental being. So one of those families of types is called exiles. So exiles are the parts of our being that we push down and away, and we get away from. And for me, that would primarily be fear. And I call them the hounds, because I see my fear as kind of shackled up in thick locked cages, because I've spent so much time dumping them down. And I'm very afraid of my fear. And as soon as fear tickles, I become outrageous, and I can't think straight, and I become frustrated, and everything starts to shut down. And then anger comes and opens all the doors of the kennels that my hounds of fear are, with their frothing lips as they angrily trot back forth and forth trying to get out of their cages. And then anger comes and says, let's go. And so I've spent so much time stuffing fear down. You know, one of the things that Dr. Schwartz says is that a lot of our parts are made in our past. A lot of them are defense mechanisms. So when we sit with ourselves and we ask our fearful self how old we are, and when I do that, you know, my hounds come across as being very young, 4, 5, 6 years old. So these parts of myself are not only immature, and the fear is itself a defense in a way, because it, while being completely afraid, you can't be overwhelmed by it, if that makes any sense. But you can be overwhelmed by fear. So another exile of mine would be what I call the authoritarian parent. So I wanted to use these three examples of my exiles because I see a strong connection, and they're all in tandem, like a daisy chain or dominoes hitting one to the next. And when one gets triggered, this is kind of the cascade of events that happens. So my authoritarian parent was also born from my observations when I was very young. You see, at least this is what I've come to terms with. So we have these parts that we are, that either make us feel uncomfortable, or we have disidentified with because they are the aggressors or the monsters of our world. So for this sort of therapy, even though it may be difficult and we may need help, and that may be in the action of a therapist, we may not be able to do this by ourselves. But going in and finding the parts that inspire the hounds of fear, and talking to them, and trying to find how and why they got to where they are, because we have an ability from our center, which is what Schwartz calls the self. So, in the center, behind all the parts, is a being of calm, compassionate, curious energy. And when we are not blended, which means when we are not playing or letting our parts come into our being and run rampant, fear can exist inside. But when fear becomes blended with myself, my heart rate rises, my throat clenches, my stomach hurts, I feel cold. See, these are responses of my physical body that show me that I'm blending with something that's not myself. When I'm in my compassionate center, you know, I feel whole, and I feel comfortable, and I feel good, and I feel this resounding buzz that even is in all my extremities and in my fingers. It's pure presence. And when I'm not feeling in that center, that's when I'm blending. And so that's part of this therapy as well, is being able to notice when we are being affected by these different segments of our personality. In the before image, when I'm one composite self, there's a lot of shame and guilt when I do all these things. But now I can look back and say, oh, you know, several years ago I had a very tense moment and I decided to react this way. This is what makes me feel safe. This is what makes me feel comfortable, even if it doesn't. You know, I've fallen into this pattern of being, and this part continues to come up to try to protect me. And there are these exercises that we could do during quiet moments of like meditation, when we can sit down and actually try to talk to these pieces, which is something that I've been doing for several years, but I would have never wanted to talk to anybody about, before reading this book, because of ideas of insanity or dissociative identity disorder. But this guy kind of mainstreams it and says that we all have a lot of different parts of our personality. And I like that. So the second family of beings is called the managers. So managers are things that keep things going, and they're aware of the exiles, and a lot of the managers' jobs is to do things and to set up activities to keep the exiles down and exiles away. But imagine an external family. You know, you have a mom and a dad and a couple kids, and one of the kids is starting to feel his oats. And the attitudes and actions have been damaging to the family. So the family has decided to put that kid in a room and not let him play and ground him and yell and bastardize and do all this kind of stuff. You know, if we are treating that segment of the external family member that way, how do you expect that person to act? Do you think they're going to be like happy with it and be like, okay, I'm a piece of shit, I guess I should just be a piece of shit, right? No. Most people clench back and they resist. You know, I found that in labeling theory, if you label somebody as a bad person, they sort of embrace it. And you label somebody as bad and you're going to make them worse. You label somebody as good and you'll make them better. Like, not through your own will, but people become self-fulfilling prophecies through this looking glass self when they see themselves in the mirrors of your reflections of them. So, I have a couple managers. I've been a pot smoker for a long time. Marijuana keeps me dull and low, and, you know, I love it. To be honest, I'm not sure if I'll ever stop doing marijuana. It's become a self-medication since I was a child. But I'm very aware that all of this chemical does is kind of stunt the natural energy and anxiety that I had. So it is related to my fear. And the more pot I smoke, the harder it is for me to hear the breathing of my hounds in the inside. And I've wondered maybe if that could be not the best situation. I also have a busy taskmaster. I'm so busy all the time. I'm always doing stuff and working and taking care and doing shit. And then when I get home, I have to do chores because I'm a homemaker, and me and my son live on my own. And so I like to keep my house nice, and that takes a lot of energy. So most days I don't get to stop doing things until 7:30 at night. And that's when I can finally sit down and do what I would like to do and relax. So my taskmaster keeps me busy, and this busyness also keeps me disassociated from my fears. But I found that in the action of even cleaning, you know, I can clean in two different ways. I can clean frantically, and I can clean with an aggressive energy because I'm feeling afraid, or I can clean out of a sense of pride because I'm trying to take care of my home. So I've been trying to switch that from the former to the latter over time, and it doesn't always happen. But I'm trying to work with my manager because I can't get rid of any of these pieces, and I can't stuff them in a room because then they'll just resist and get stronger. So I have to learn how to work with the pieces of me. Another manager that I have is this thing I call the good boy persona. You know, I'm always trying to make people happy, and I'm a pushover, and I have tried to give compassion, and I persistently push on this show an idea of controlled love. You know, I think that we are all special, and that our, on the very depths of our soul is a kernel of divinity where this love comes from. And I do believe that. But often, you know, I could be disingenuous with my compassion, and I'm just using this persona to be nice, even though I am struggling on the inside because I'm not where I'm supposed to be. So this manager is also there because as long as I'm acting in this way, people don't fight back or bite at you so much when you're perpetually soothing their own ego. You know, but it's not good for your own self not to be original and to be who you are. So another one of these families of beings is called firefighters. And so firefighters come in. So managers are long-term. They're long-term habits that have been instilled for a long time. You know, most of these defense mechanisms come from childhood, I would believe. But the firefighters are short-term responses. So in a very short, expedient moment of stimulus, you know. So my firefighters are hard substance abuse. You know, I've had a lot of times in the past where I've fallen into alcohol or depressants like heroin, which these hard depressants are complete dissociations from reality, which is why they make so much hell, because when you push down all of those exiles and all those fears and you're just drunk or high, as soon as you come down, all those things come back with a vengeance, and they know that you've just been hitting them with a baseball bat. You know, you've been knocking them out cold because you can't stand their presence. And imagine how much shame you would feel if somebody knocked you out cold in that sort of situation. And I also have panic attacks, which it took me a while thinking about these situations to really come to terms with how this activity was what it was. But my panic attacks are linked to my bad parenting too, which is part of that exile relationship. And I've been having panic attacks since I was very young. And what it is it's a complete dropping of all activity, really. And it's just freaking out. And what I found is it's not always, like, it's very uncomfortable. But it's hard to dig oneself out of that state of mind, because it sort of holds on to itself. Even deep depressions, it can be hard to walk outside of a deep depression, because while you're in it, not being depressed almost seems counterintuitive. I don't know if that makes any sense. So my panic attacks have been these intense reactions to external stimuli that shut them down immediately. And then all you could deal with is me, because nobody can even focus on what happened. So these firefighters have good intentions too, if you really think about it. You know, a firefighter is trying to put out a fire. And the manager might come in afterward and say, hey, firefighter, you're messing with what I'm doing. And then we have all these more conflictions, and then you have shame and you have guilt. And these things reinforce themselves. So that's a very brief overview on this idea. I encourage you to go look into it more. Internal Family Systems, IFS. I find it very intriguing. It's been a part of the composite of what I'm building for myself. And it helped me for sure. And I've been sitting in a lot of these moments in meditation using the exercises from this book to good effect. Part of the reason why I found so much connection with this idea is because of my use of psychedelic medicines over the past decades. Specifically psilocybin, which is fungus. I found that, especially during high doses of psilocybin, I have this ability to fragment, which my fragments are very similar to these parts talked about in the book. And I never had any sort of idea that these fragments weren't me. And I've never talked to aliens or anything that wasn't me. I've never seen anything that wasn't a piece of my soul. But with the use of a psychedelic, my fragments could have very heavy personalities to the point where I could have very rich conversations with myself. And I've been having these moments for years and been able to work through a lot of my shit and been able to fall in love with me because of those conversations and those moments. And in this book, that's what a lot of these exercises are, is while sober, just sitting and talking to ourselves, which is something I really never felt openly advocated to do. And I think it's amazing. And I want to tell everybody else that they should be talking to themselves more and paying attention to your thoughts. You know, we don't want to demonize them, and we don't want to sit in silence and quiet. The transcendental meditation where we are in a void may be helpful, but I'm really thinking that I'm going to be paying attention to my thoughts a lot more when I'm in my meditative moments. One of my most important fragmentations I had was approximately 2 years ago. I had a surgery on my leg that I was very afraid of, and I was terrified because I've always had this intense fear of needles, which I don't know why. But I took a high dose of psilocybin and I sat for 3 hours and I ran a conversation with the doctor where I played both the doctor and the person over and over and over again until I felt comfortable with it. And when in the real world I was able to go and see the doctor, I had already worked through a lot of those tensions and fears because they were on my side, not hers. And I think that's a lot of how living in life is. I really do. So, think about it. Think about you. You're a wonderful being with a lot of different edges. And I love every one of them. So, before we end, I'd like to do a brief expose on Prop 122 here in my state of Colorado, because I've heard a little bit of back and forth on what it is and people who are for or against it. So I'm going to start by reading it out loud. I have a picture of the proposition right in front of me. We're going to be voting on it locally. If I get my phone to load. And here it is. Proposition 122. Access to natural psychedelic medicines and substances, placed on the ballot by Citizen Initiative. Proposition 122 proposes to amend Colorado statuses to, by late 2024, allow the supervised use of psychedelic mushrooms by individuals aged 21 and over at licensed facilities and require the state to create a regulatory structure for the operation of these licensed facilities. Bullet point 2. Allow the state to expand the type of substances that may be used in licensed facilities to include the use of additional plant-based psychedelic substances, including dimethyltryptamine, ibogaine, or mescaline, starting in 2026. Bullet point number 3, this is the important one. Decriminalize the personal possession, growing, sharing, and use, but not the sale, of 5 natural psychedelic medicines by individuals aged 21 and over, including 2 substances found in psychedelic mushrooms, psilocybin and psilocin, and 3 plant-based psychedelic substances, dimethyltryptamine, ibogaine, and mescaline. Bullet point 4. Allow local governments to regulate the time, place, and manner of operation of these facilities while prohibiting the local governments from banning licensed facilities, services, and use of natural psychedelic substances. And, bullet point 5, establish penalties for individuals under the age of 21 for possessing, using, or transporting natural psychedelic substances aged 21 and over. Basically, anybody under 21 can't do it. All right. So, a lot of scary shit and a lot of good shit in there. And I'm going to go over pros and cons here. Pros. What this does is it follows the route of medical marijuana here in my state and paves the way for easier access and less fear in the use of these medicines. I want to say that again. Less fear. I can't tell you how afraid I used to be smoking marijuana when I was younger. The day I turned 18 and I got my medical card was one of the best days of my life, and it felt like taking 200 billion pounds of baggage off my back, because I knew that from that point on, nobody could prosecute me or put me in jail for something that I was doing. Before and after, I felt 100% less fear because of a simple regulative legislature and because of a stupid card, yes. And I was smoking pot the same before and after, but when I had easier access to it, I didn't have to go into skeevy situations and talk to people and black market dealers. I haven't had a pot dealer since I was 18 because I could go get it anywhere, you know? But the fear aspect, how much more comfortable I felt smoking afterwards because I knew that I was safe. That's so important. Now, there's a lot of steps in the future that we'll have to go to get a regulative infrastructure that is facility-based to an easy, you know, like recreational atmosphere like we have now with marijuana, where almost everybody has marijuana, you know? And a big part of Colorado, outside of Colorado Springs, is recreational. So there's recreational and medical marijuana. So in Colorado Springs, where I live, there's no rec. So you can't just go in and flash your ID. But you can get a medical marijuana card, which is very easy, and go in and get it. But the rest of the state, you can come in from out of state, be like a Nevada state or Wyoming citizen, and come in with your ID. You can flash that ID and go in and get it, completely accessibility, you know? Like, but it took a lot of changes over the last 20 years to get from a medical infrastructure to that recreational infrastructure. And it took time for people to be able to be adaptable to it, especially the people who aren't users, who don't smoke marijuana, who will never use psychedelic medicines, who look at this population and be like, what the fuck are you doing? All right. So this is a start, and there will be a lot of things that will change after that, that have to change. But you have to be optimistic, because as soon as you reduce fear and you make it easier, that changes people's lives. And that's a big deal. Two, cultivability. Mushrooms are very, very easy to grow. Marijuana is very difficult, time intensive, and expensive. If you want to grow indoors, you're going to spend a lot of money on dirt, nutrients, and fucking electricity. And most likely people can literally take a picture of your house and see the electricity output, or at least read your fucking meter and be like, what the hell are you doing? So it's so much easier to cultivate mushrooms, which is why they've been almost impossible to stamp out, is because it's stupid easy for anybody to do it. People are already doing it before Prop 22. There is hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people cultivating mushrooms in my state right now, and it would be impossible to catch them all. But afterwards, with that ease of access, less fear, imagine those cultivators being able to do it easier. I just have this feeling that it's not going to be just like marijuana, because not everybody can grow marijuana. You know, it's difficult, but almost anybody could grow a mushroom if you're clean and you follow the process. So I'm just optimistic that if we make an environment where people are comfortable to do it, more and more people make them accessible, more like a farmer's market. I don't see mushroom dispensaries, you know, maybe for a short while, but 10 to 15 years from now, once it's a lot more available, you know, and once people have adapted and are okay with their fellow citizens being able to experiment with the solidarity of their own consciousness, things will change. Cons: regulation and government intervention. These are the two biggest things that I hear about people falling back on when they see this law, because I posted a picture of it and I've been having a lot of discussion with it on the internet. Yes, regulation's not ideal. Yes, like homegrown marijuana is always going to be better than wholesale, like by taste, flavor, everything. Somebody who spends their time and their effort and breaks their back to grow a pot plant, that pot is going to be a hell of a lot better than a huge regulated facility growing hundreds and hundreds of pot plants. Duh. But I don't think it's just going to be government facilities growing. I really don't. And that bullet point number three, where people can just easily give them, you know, the only thing that will be illegal is the point of sale, which people still do it with pot nowadays. And I'm pretty sure that's on the book still. Like, yes, we need to be wary of the government's ability to come in and make statements about what we can do with our own minds. But we also have to work with the government, because they're part of our society and our structure. And people need to remember that they are simply just a part of this whole societal structure, like a big external family system. The people are 99.9% of what this country is us, and the ones who decide to and to not do these things. You know, remember that we can't demonize the government either. We have to work with it, because it's just an expression of ourselves. It really is that small of an entity. We can pave ways and pave changes by voting and by doing things and by accepting others' abilities to do things. So even if you never want to touch a psychedelic medicine, which I respect you for being there, if you've never touched any sort of psychotropic substance, I respect you for being there. And I wish I was you. But can you allow somebody else the freedom to want to go try? Is that ever a problem? Well, anyways, I think I'm going to read a couple quotes and we'll sign off with Mr. O. Thank you. I know I got a little heated there. I'm still thinking about it. But I really appreciate your attention and ears. And I want you to know that you can email me at the gingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com, which is very easily available in the show notes. I'd love to have a discussion with you, especially if you have any opinion about any of the things that I talked about today, or if you want some help finding access to the book I talked about today. Please email me and I'd love to help. Anywho, let me go find my book. This is from No Bad Parts by Richard C. Swartz, PhD. It's coming from towards the end of the book, from a chapter called Self-Leadership. He's definitely kind of like wrapping it up at this point. So let's go. From my perspective then, these are what Ken Wilber calls peak experiences, in the sense that we are getting a peek or a glimpse of the pure self that is always there. It's just that it's usually obscured by our parts and their burdens. We are indeed communing with God if you consider self to be the God within us. The qualities listed above from Taylor's research are remarkably similar to the 8 C's covered earlier. Connectedness and clarity, we're part of the same ocean. Calm and confidence, everything is okay. Compassion for everyone. And courage, no more fear of death. We can imagine that people also touch the other 2 C's, curiosity in terms of awe at the whole experience, and creativity in the form of the epiphanies that are often reported. Do these peak experiences of accessing pure self and feeling connected to everything create a different mindset? Researchers Kate Dibbles and Mark Leary developed a brief belief in oneness scale and correlated the degree to which people hold such beliefs with their general value. The scale used the following 6 items. 1. Beyond surface appearances, everything is fundamentally one. 2. Although many seemingly separate things exist, they are all parts of the same whole. 3. At the most basic level of reality, everyone is one. 4. The separation among individual things is an illusion. In reality, everything is one. 5. Everything is composed of the same basic substance, whether one thinks of it as spirit, consciousness, quantum process, or whatever. 6. The same basic essence permeates everything that exists. They found that those who scored higher on this scale were far more likely to identify with and feel connected to distant people and with aspects of nature than those at lower scores. They were also more likely to have compassion for the welfares of others because of feelings connected to a common humanity, common problem, and imperfection. In other words, experiencing a state of pure self changes people. As the veils of separateness fall away and they experience the reality of our interconnectedness, they become more self-led inside and out. Ralph De La Rosa suggests that at least his version of Buddhism aligns with this position. It might seem that we have to generate the sense of openness, freshness, joy, revelry, or stillness to touch in such moments. From the Buddhist perspective, however, such a state of being is already there within us and has been so since the beginning. It's tantalizing to think that perhaps expansiveness lies waiting to be uncovered within us, while we go searching for it everywhere else. It's not something we go toward so much as it is what we are left with when we all are running around ceases. Our deeper nature is simply what's left when we put down the endless task of trying to be somebody. Beautiful. All right, let's see what Mr. O has to say.
Hello, people. This is Asko talking.
Woo!
So, how was your fall break?
I don't know. How was yours?
Great. I was doing great in school.
Woo!
He really has. I'm very, very proud of him. He's been doing amazing in school.
I can tell you what I've been doing in school. I'm really impressed the teachers.
You really impressed the teachers?
Yes. Sorry, people. So, I was thinking. I wanted to tell you. Said, why?
I'm going to be focusing on this one.
Hello, people. Sorry.
You're good. He's just excited.
Well, today we're gonna go on a movie, the new Rock movie.
Yeah, gotta check that out.
The See. Famous Rock Johnson.
Oh no. All right. Well, thank you guys. We really appreciate you. Wanna say bye, all?
Bye.
Thanks.